We are in the public hearing and possible work session for Thursday, June 3rd, Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee for Natural Resources. Today we are continuing our hearing on House Bill 5047, the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Mr. Benner, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, is here. He has been taking us through the issues and options before us in the consideration of House Bill 5047. Good morning, Mr. Benner.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. When we closed down yesterday, we were going quickly through the packages, and I had gotten to the point of beginning to explain package number 108, legal costs, and briefly I had said that last biennium, a portion of our regular budget for legal expenses had been put in the emergency board. And we had come on several occasions to seek release of that money, $150,000. Ultimately, all but $20,000 of it was released to the agency. Approximately $20,000 was not released. And that happened. The $130,000 or so was finally released after the time for computing the current budget. And so this package is to restore us to a level of service that is somewhat similar to what we've had in previous biennials. Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I would like to pass out a chart, unless Mr. Rocco is all right. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, you have my permission to pass out. Your chart. What page are we on the budget option in our new book? Sure.
Yes, I'm on page 104 that has the list of the packages in the agency summary of that one kind of way. There's a better one. Putting on that idea.
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you. And 104 is a listing of the packages. 104 through 108.
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett.
What I wanted to show to you in this chart is what we get for our money, the Attorney General's office. If you go to the column all the way over to the right, you see in 95-97 biennium, we got approximately $320,000 for AG expenses. And if you look down to the bold line, the rate we were being charged then by the AG's office was $72 an hour, and that gave us 4,444 hours of service. If you continue along that bold line, you see in the current biennium, the rate had gone up $79 an hour, so $324,000 would have yielded 4,107 hours of service. And then if you go to the 99-01 column, our base is $195,000. That's without the package. And that would give us 2,124 hours of service. So that would be less than half the amount of service we had in 95-97. With the package 108, that is $174,000, the total would be 372. That would give us 4,000 hours of service at the $92 rate. So if you were to approve package 108, we would still be down about 400 hours from where we were two biennials ago. If we are forced to deal with just the base, $195,000, 2,000 hours of Attorney General service will not allow us to do the rulemaking that we have to do. It will not allow us to enforce the statewide planning program. So that is that package. Number three, excuse me, package number 109 is the management restructure. You'll see that that takes no general fund and a relatively small amount of other fund and federal fund, because the positions that would be restructured are not general funded positions. This gets back to something I discussed very briefly yesterday. The agency approximately 6 or 7 years ago like other agencies, went through a flattening process. And I don't mean budget cuts. I mean we were asked to get with the modern movement, to span a control movement, to have fewer managers for a given number of employees. And the rule of thumb was to get to one manager to every 9 employees. That was harder for smaller agencies to do, but eventually we got there. And in the past 3 bienniums, I guess, we have added some additional field people, and we are now finding that we are short on management. So what this package would enable us to do is not create any new management positions, but rather to take a couple of positions that we have currently given some supervisory responsibilities to and make them into management positions. And the cost of that package is $18,000. Again, there's no general fund involved.
Sure.
Question?
Well, the question encourages you to pay overtime. Joke, that was in the paper today. Back to 108 for just a second. I can't get these figures to add up. Your base and your option package 108 don't equal the total budget.
That's the 195 plus 174.
It only equals 372,297. Well, 5 months, but I was kind of curious if there's something else we're missing.
No, I don't see anything else. It must just be an addition here.
Okay. Well, no overtime for that person that did the addition.
Mm-hmm. That person has been fired.
Okay. Now working in Fish and Wildlife, Fish and Wildlife.
Yeah. Oh. Now that we have the solution to those management issues, it just needs that to...
Oh, that took care of that baggage. Yeah. So much for that. All right.
The last operations package, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is 110. That's dispute resolution. There was a statute passed last session that changed the way dispute resolution positions throughout state government were funded. That's because dispute resolution, which was begun in the state about 10 years ago, has become very popular, a very good way of resolving disputes besides going to litigation, to replace going to litigation. And previously, general fund money, by and large, was being used to pay for the few positions that existed. As the popularity has increased and the demand for dispute resolution has grown, last session you changed the law to pay for the positions by a filing fee that is accompanied, that is paid when somebody goes to circuit court to file some kind of a lawsuit. The initial calculations were that the fees generated by those filings would be sufficient to pay for each of the positions, and that was our expectation. As it has turned out, it has not been sufficient. It has been nearly but not quite sufficient to pay for the position. So in the last biennium, we were somewhat short of being able to pay for the position. We were not able to do it with fees, so we had to pay for it by economizing in other areas. And the request here is to make up the difference between our experience with the filing fees and the cost of the service, and it comes to $12,750.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there some place in the book that explains your packages? I'm working off the totals, and I don't see anything.
152 is one of 152.
Yeah, if you turn, there's a tab in your book called Operations Program 001. You'll find the packages under there. And this particular one, I think, is 152. Well, that's 109. It's on page 155. I think most of you know this, but as a result of changes made in the program before the beginning of last biennium, there are now Each agency is part of a cluster. Our agency is part of the natural resources cluster, and each cluster of agencies has a dispute resolution coordinator. That coordinator is with our agency. That's what these funds pay for. And the function of this position is to work with the natural resources agencies to get them used to the notion of dispute resolution, to train their people in it, to work with the Dispute Resolution Commission to maintain a list of qualified facilitators in the private sector so that when a dispute arises and there's some opportunity to resolve it short of litigation, our coordinator will link the agency that's looking for assistance with a facilitator, and there are generally grant dollars that are available in order to support, at least in part, the resolution of the dispute. Grants program, there is $200,000 that you have earmarked in previous bienniums for dispute resolution. So let's say there's a dispute between two landowners or the county and a landowner or a county and an agency in Coos County. If it involves natural resources, the dispute would come to the attention of our coordinator, and there would be an assessment made of the case to see whether it meets the criteria for resolution. And if it does, then we would make a grant to Coos County of some dimension, maybe $1,000, $500, maybe $4,000, to pay the expense of a facilitator to resolve that dispute. And so each of the five agency clusters has a coordinator like that.
Mr. Chair. Question, Senator Trump.
Hey, where does your facilitator come from? Are they an arbiter, a mediator, or are these individuals already online that you hire to do the job?
Senator, the Dispute Resolution Commission, which is an Oregon state agency that you fund, maintains a list of qualified people, so they are ready and can be put on job quickly on the contract.
Sir? Question.
Question, Mr. Chair. How many disputes have you been involved in this last meeting?
I would have to look that up, Representative Messerly, but I think if you, in this book here that was a presentation to you, under tab 5, if you turn to page 31, under tab 5, there's a section here called Dispute Resolution, and it describes the program. If you... Yeah, I thought perhaps I had a list of disputes, but I don't. I can certainly get it for you. It's quite lengthy, actually. Over the last 6 years, as I mentioned, the popularity of the program has gone up considerably. We have no difficulty at all using the $200,000. And I would, from looking at lists, my guess would be there were probably 25 to 30 disputes that went through the program in the fiscal year, and it may be more than that, but I'd be happy to give you a list. In fact, the program maintains a list of all the disputes from the beginning of the program, how they were resolved, who the parties were, and what the cost of each one was.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
In Senate Bill 924, the Oregon Plan last session, there was a section in that dealt specifically with conflict resolution. How many cases did your agency get involved with?
Involving that kind of dispute?
And with the Oregon Plan.
Representative Messerly, I'm afraid I can't answer that. I'd have to go look at the list. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, that's just a statement. I don't know what has happened in the last 6 months, but at one point our interim committee reviewed that and there had been no request for a dispute resolution, even though there was lots of disputes with the permits in the activity in the Oregon plan. So I'm not blaming that on your agency, just that I think since then the Division of State Lands has incorporated that as a statement in the permit application. If you have a conflict with this, to notify certain people. I assume that is the agency then?
Yes, it probably would be. since it seems like it would be part of the natural resources cluster. There is also, again, as a result of a statute you passed several sessions ago, a requirement that when an appeal is filed with the Land Use Board of Appeals, that LUBA sends a notice back to the petitioner that this program is available with the brochure that describes it, with the hope that that would divert some of the disputes away from the LUBA process. But I'd be happy to give you a list of the disputes that have come before the program.
Appreciate that. One more, Mr. Chair. It would seem like a conflict of interest if your agency has filed a claim with LUBA, and then your agency is also involved with resolution of the dispute. Is that? I seen something here that's not there.
Well, Representative Messerly, the coordinator who works for our agency does not himself get involved in the dispute. So he would not serve as facilitator, although he could. I mean, he does have those skills, but he does not do that. All that he would do, I'm trying to think of an example, and I really can't think of one. We've had dispute resolution used to resolve matters that come before the commission through periodic review, but I can't think of one that flowed from an appeal filed. We have engaged in negotiations during the pendency of an appeal and resolved matters short of appeal, but we were able to do that without the facilitators. I understand what your point is, but I can't think of an instance where that has come up.
Thank you.
To finish off the packages, the second set is the grants packages, which you will find described under the tab Grants Program -003, and there are four of them, two of which have no money from the governor's recommended, so I will only talk about Package 302, Healthy Streams, and Package 306, Coastal Zone Management. 302, these are the dollars, grant dollars, that would be passed through the governor's Watershed Enhancement Board to local governments in order to revise their comprehensive plans and zoning ordinances, particularly to make changes to their riparian regulations, if they have them, or to adopt them in the first instance if they don't. This biennium, there were $320,000 in grants available for the salmon plan. They were spent largely on the coast because at the beginning of the biennium, that's where the listings were. As you know, during this interim, there were listings in several other parts of the state, so now a large portion of the state's geography is subject to one listing or another. And to cover an additional number of jurisdictions, we've increased $320,000 to $670,000. That will enable us to hit a lot more jurisdictions, to aid a lot more jurisdictions. Our approach here has been to try to cover the entire cost to the local government of the changes, because local governments have a lot of other stuff to do, and they're generally understaffed, and that's why we're trying to cover the entire cost. The last package...
Is there a description of that package? I'm planning that one.
Representative King, it should be, that's 302.
171.
172 is where the numbers are. Thank you. And the text is on 171, yeah. Mr. Chairman, I know you wanted to get through those packages quickly, and I'd be happy to go back over any one of them if you like.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Representative Jensen? Just quickly, other funds specifically, what are the other funds?
In package 101,
302.
Oh, I'm sorry, 302. Perhaps Mr. Rocco can answer that for you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, the other funds in package 302 were anticipated to be from the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board's grant program. However, with the changes to that program with ballot measure 66 and House Bill 3225, we would anticipate the source of those would be measure 66 lottery dollars. And that discussion will likely take place when that bill comes before this committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Benrath, we interrupted you. You were about to do the summary of the last package.
Well, the Coastal Zone Management Package 306. The description of it on 175 and then the numbers on 176. We have a lot of variability in the coastal zone management program because each time Congress passes a budget, it gives a little bit more or a little bit less to this particular coastal zone management program. Consequently, we never are certain how much money is going to be available. We found that there was going to be an opportunity perhaps to enhance the grants program to pass through to local governments this time around. So we're looking for the limitation in the event that there actually is more money made available to the Oregon program so that we're ready to receive it if that happens. That occurs fairly regularly during the course of the congressional budget-making process. And if you've served on the emergency board in the past, almost every biennium, we're able to come in and ask for limitation for either a new program or an enhancement. So this would put us in a position to do a little bit more work this year, this biennium.
Mr. Chair?
Question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're applying for $100,000 more to distribute as grants to cities and counties, is that right?
Yes, if you approve this package, it would give us the limitation to receive the federal funds, which we could then pass along.
And do you withhold any of those funds for administrative costs?
Not of these. No, administrative.
Mr. Chair, I guess I've had a problem as we've discussed this budget in previous days as well. Out of the roughly $2.5 million that this agency gets from the federal government for coastal zone management, $2.1 million, it appears to me, stays in the administrative of the program in Salem, or maybe even part of it in Portland. And it would seem to me that there's a problem. Those funds should get down to the areas and the communities where they're trying to work out the problems. So I don't know, as far as this package, $100,000, I don't know if it can be distributed that amongst all the counties and the cities. It really doesn't make a lot of difference. But I am concerned about the base budget.
I think there was another concern, I'm not sure to echo what you're referring to, that we discussed earlier in the year. If colleagues will look at page 120 in the revenue forecast, you'll note that the federal mandate for the department to participate in non-source point water pollution planning remains unfunded. And the standards and deadlines have requirements have a deadline. But if we don't meet the deadline, we lose 30% of federal coastal zone management funds. And so I'm concerned that we have been given a set of requirements. We're looking at a 30% reduction in federal funding if we don't meet the requirements, yet the federal mandate comes with no federal appropriations to meet the mandate. Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Benner made the point, too. I mean, I understand Representative Messerly's concern, but I think Mr. Benner made the point yesterday that a lot of these funds aren't for distribution. They're for complying with the federal requirements that get us the money in the first place. So it's one thing to, you know, I'm fine with going after an agency that over-bureaucratizes their money and doesn't give it out for services, but in this particular case, the money's earmarked for specific functions, not money to be distributed. And the money that is distributed. That it comes out to only 400 and some thousand out of 2 million, has more to do with how the money's earmarked than delivery of services. I mean, they're not just a pass-through agency. You know, they're not just a grant-providing agency.
Mr. Chairman? All right. Several members yesterday had a question about the allocation of CVM funds, and we produced something which Mr. Rocco can pass around to you. That will give you an opportunity to see where the money comes from, which particular coastal zone management program back in D.C. it comes from, and where the money goes.
Chairman's going to turn the gavel over to Senator Tarnow for the next 10 or 15 minutes. I'd like to, before I leave, ask you to go ahead and pursue the issues of coastal zone management. And I see that she's using here from the OCDMA. So this is an issue that is critical to the orderly development of the coastal zone plans, and I think I'll spend a few minutes on it. But I'm called away to a hearing. The gavel is Senator Tarnow.
Dick, why don't you walk us through the page that was just passed out to us by the King or one of the attorney staff.
What we've done here in response to your questions yesterday is to give you a full breakdown. Again, with me on my left is Paul Quarin, who works with the Ocean and Coastal Program. When you get to the numbers, on the left side, you see the grants that come in. This is a quarterly biennium. The principal one is Section 306, and that's obviously the largest amount. And then these section numbers, by the way, are sections in the Coastal Zone Management Act. So that gets us to the $2.5 million expenditure categories are on the right. And then below that, Mr. Quarin has given you an explanation of each of the expenditure categories. So if you want me to just go through it or you want to read it for a moment, I would also note on the back, you can see a listing of the grant recipients, the interagency agreements that result in a pass-through from us to, say, Department of Environmental Quality, and then contract work as well.
Dick, let me ask, is there an obligation on our part to adhere to federal guidelines on the allotment of these federal monies? And can you kind of give us an idea of what those guidelines are and how we are to use those federal funds? I mean, we've got the 306 package of $1.8 million program implementation, but is there federal requirements on how we are to use these funds that you have to adhere to?
Well, yes, there are. They're going to vary for each one of these under federal grants. They're going to vary for each one of the provisions of the Act.
And I don't want to dwell on this too long. I just want to make sure that the committee's comfort level is up a little bit so we have a better understanding of what those guidelines are. So, Paul, go ahead.
Good morning, committee. Mr. Toronto. Under the Coastal Zone Act, Coastal Management Act 306, we have a federally approved program that is constituted with specific...
For record, your name, please.
Paul Quarin with the Department of Land Conservation Development and Coastal Ocean Investment Program. Start with a K. Under Coastal Zone Management Act and all of these various sections of it, we are specifically required to carry out different tasks. We have an approved program that has within it various components that we are required to do that deal with planning for hazards, dealing with water pollution, public access. There's, I think, 8 or 9 different components to the act itself, and we're required to do those through our state program. Some of those activities can be implemented at the local level, but certainly not all of them. Many of them are on a statewide basis only. So to answer, yes, we are required to spend that money on program components that are dictated by the federal program. And that's very clear. And they come out every other year and actually review our program. They're going to be here, in fact, next week. The federal government will be here for the entire week, and they'll be reviewing our program to ensure that we do exactly that. And they'll be speaking to the stakeholders in the program, including other federal agencies, state agencies, local governments, the public. They'll be holding a public hearing on the coast, and they'll review our program to ensure that we do comply with the Coastal Zone Management Act.
Paul, give us an idea what is meant by administration and operations. That's $1.7 million expenses there. So what does that entail when you define administration and operations?
That's the basic coastal program staff. That's our field representatives, folks like myself and Don Oswald who deal with hazards, public access, coastal goal implementation, that's goal 15, 17, 18, 19, the Ocean Territorial Sea Program, the federal consistency, which is a very important part of our program, which is where we review federal activities to make sure they comply with state laws and local plans, agency coordination, the non-point source pollution program, which you just referred to recently, and I don't know what the chair was reading from, but we in fact do receive money from the federal government under what is known as Section 6217 non-point pollution control. We do receive money from them for that program, and in fact in the next biennium we'll be receiving more money from them for that program. And they very specifically dictate to us that the money has to be spent on that and that alone. And in fact, this next biennium, they will be giving us an increased amount of money. And we don't have any choice on how we're to spend that. And to be honest with you, we don't have any warning on how much they're going to give us. They tell us at the very last moment, we're going to give you $100,000 or $200,000, and it has to be spent there. That goes to support a staff member, and then some of it we spend in contracts.
The territorial fee plan was updated a few years ago. How often do you folks go through that particular plan and update it? I don't know if there's that much involvement in updating the territorial fee plan, but you mentioned that part of the responsibilities that you have.
Well, OPAC is a sitting body that was constituted by a statute that you passed many years ago.
The Ocean Policy Advisory Council.
And it, in fact, is meeting tomorrow. So they're constantly reviewing how the plan is implemented and thinking about what it is.
Do we have a set of copies of one of the latest version of the territorial sheet plan?
Yeah. Certainly did.
I don't know if members of the committee have had a chance to go through that, but it might be good just to give it to them. They can read it during their own time. It's kind of informative, I thought.
I would expect one of the items on the agenda tomorrow will be cables, given the experience with the AT&T cable just weeks ago. The plan itself talks about placing a higher priority on renewable resources over non-renewable resources and found that it did not specifically address cable laying because it's obviously not a renewable resource and it's not clearly a non-renewable resource, so there was no language that clearly applies to the laying of cable, so that would then result probably in an amendment to the territorial sea plan.
And I'm kind of curious how we dovetail in the territorial sea plan and in with the state lands issues as they as related to AT&T cables coming in. So if we have that, we'd be kind of Cal, Mr. King.
Well, I just wanted to follow up a little bit when he was saying it's not a non-renewable resource, and that's certainly a fact, but the fact that they lay the cable down potentially eliminates what can be considered a renewable resource when you're taking, you know, that ocean bed out of commercial fishing production.
Is it, Mr.?
Thank you, Chair. I understand the requirements of the federal government for these programs and funds. Do you have the flexibility to contract with other groups, such as the Coastal Zone Management Association, to administer these kind of programs?
We have that flexibility, and we do. If you look on the back of that sheet, you'll see all the various types of contracts and interagency agreements we have. We cannot pass through any of our ability to our authorities. So our authorities don't pass on to a contractor. We're the only ones who have those particular authorities. So what we can contract for is work that helps us carry out our authorities, but we can't simply pass that responsibility along to a contractor. Clearly, we can't do that. So what we typically contract for are services, either technical or other, that help us carry out the program.
Oh, Mr. Chair. Or you can't contract with other state agencies?
Yes, we do. On the back, you'll see a list of the state agencies that we have agreements with and the funds that we pass through to them for various tasks. You know, the ODF&W helps us collect data on resource inventory in the ocean and territorial sea so that we can better understand our fisheries. We have OSU Sea Grant Extension, which provides outreach, workshops, education, training, things like that. There's a lot of work with the public doing interpretive services on the coast. We pass money through to the Parks and Recreation Department that goes directly then to Tillamook County from them so that Tillamook County can do planning, specifically planning for hazards on its beaches. So we do pass through a lot of funds, in fact, $318,000 during the past biennium to other state agencies for that work. And that's typically technical work that we don't have staff to do, and they're the best resource for that.
Sure, one more follow-up if I might. I guess I'm more concerned about coordination type activities or planning activities, but whether you could contract through OSU Extension or through OCZMA to coordinate the coastal counties or the coastal communities. You're not allowed to do that then?
We won't be allowed to do that. Coordination between jurisdictions or between state agencies and jurisdictions, I'm not quite clear.
All there, bud.
We do that ourselves constantly. That, I think, involves many of our staff. We work with state agencies, we work with federal agencies, and we work with local governments, and we work with associations like the Commercial Fishermen's Association very often, bringing those parties together to deal with different planning issues. That's, I think, what our main task is and our strength, and we're able to do that in the fiber optic.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question was, can you contract that kind of
thing? Yes, we could.
And still qualify for the federal grants?
Yes, we could.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. I am concerned about a disconnect between what's really going on in the local governments and the communities and what's going on with some of the agencies, state and federal. And I just think there needs to be closer contact and more coordination and whether this is done with the state agency or whether they contract it out to someone who's actually there and working with those people is maybe an issue. But it seems to me that could be a lot of improvement.
Mr. Boone, you want to address that concern?
I guess there are two points I would make. The coordination, or an awful lot of the coordination that the agency does, happens through its field representatives. And because of the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Program and the money we get from the federal government, we have a better field presence on the coast than we do anywhere else. I forget what percentage of the population lives on the Oregon coast. Senator Turner, you probably know. But we have two field representatives, North Coast, South Coast, who serve the coastal area. And that's a much better field presence than we have than anywhere else in the state. Secondly, we didn't really get a chance to get into the coastal program all that much when we were making budget presentation. And I think those of you who serve constituencies on the coast probably know this, but the Oregon Coastal Program is an interagency program. it isn't just the coastal goals. That would not have qualified us under the Coastal Zone Management Act. It is also the Division of State Lands with the Fill and Removal Law, the Department of Forestry with the Forest Practices Act, the Department of Agriculture with Senate Bill 1, whatever that the practices set of rules is, and Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. All of those make up the coastal program. So it's the expectation of the federal government that our agency, as the coastal agency, will do the coordination for the entire program, and that's what we do. That's part of, when you look at this number on the first page, coastal program implementation, $1.8 million, a significant part of that effort is the coordination that we are required to do.
And Dick, I don't want to miss that, but Paul, I think if we had an idea of the breakdown on how that 1.8 is spent, it might alleviate some of our concerns too. But that's an aside, and I don't know if we have time at this point in time to address them.
Any further?
Just a follow-up comment. I think that Representative Mitchell stated a valid concern, but I also think that probably what we're trying to do is being, you know, public stewards, just to make sure that the agency is efficient, which to a significant degree means lean. But then if we want to have closer coordination, then that's going to take more people power, you know, to do that, you know, close. And so I think that, you know, really we've got some responsibility there to kind of make that policy decision whether we want more coordination or to be, you know, leaner and more efficient, you know, in terms of personnel use and the trade-off we have to live with.
Any further, please, two gentlemen?
Also, you do it. Just want to give you back. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned non-point pollution issues, and every committee that I've been in, we keep hearing this. Everybody's doing this, and as Representative Messler was asking that question, I was thinking about the fact that there's a coordination. Define for me what you folks are going to be doing as far as non-point pollution.
We're specifically mandated by the federal government through the Coastal Management Act to develop a plan for the coastal zone that deals with non-point source pollution.
How will that impact the ground, though?
What we have found is that many of the management practices that the federal government would like to see in place nationwide are already in place in Oregon, and that we have some gaps that we have to deal with. But, in fact, Oregon is far out ahead of many of the other states in the country in terms of fulfilling what would be a non-point source pollution control program.
Well, no, specifically, the how it's going to impact landowners and actually how's it going to impact it?
As an example, one of the areas that we need to work on is when a development is taking place, when a site is being developed and you have traffic out there and you're building something, is the ability to control the runoff from that site so that you don't have sediment going into streams and rivers and lakes next to that site. And what that deals with is management practices on the site by the company that keep that soil from washing into the streams, putting up some sort of fabric, you know, putting some sort of a buffer around the area. That's the sort of thing that it deals with. And many of those come down to building codes. And not something that we would do through a planning program, but maybe through the building codes. So that's one example of that. Another would be riparian vegetation, maintaining a buffer of riparian vegetation along streams and rivers that, again, prevents sediment from flowing into the rivers and streams and causing them to be polluted.
How's that going to be achieved, though?
If I could break in here, one way to achieve it will be the program that I was talking about earlier. You'll remember Package 302, I think it was, $670,000 that would pass through to local governments to change their riparian ordinances. That's one way of doing that. In some cases, there aren't any. In some cases, they're not wide enough to act as an adequate buffer.
Okay, let's just back up and get out here to where I asked the first question, that is, to the land. Let's ask the question. Who's going to pay for the land that's now going to be an additional buffer? Who's going to pay for the planting? Who's going to pay for all that? It's nice for you guys to develop regulations, and that's exactly what I wanted to get to. But what we keep doing is spending a lot of money to develop regulation,
There's nothing out there actually helping to do the restoration, to add the riparian, maybe to purchase the property from a landowner who is being severely impacted by these regulations in place. So somehow that's going to, how are we going to get to that point? Are we just going to order them to do that and find them and see them? Or is there anything more to this than just regulation?
There's quite a bit more to it than regulation. In fact, the emphasis is not on regulation. It's on cooperative efforts between government and landowners. The riparian rules that might be in your county's zoning ordinance, for example, would say, depending upon whether maybe it's in the city or out in the country or particular zones, whatever, that a buffer needs to be 20 feet, 50 feet, whatever it might be. And all that that regulation gets to is placement of structures. If there is an instance in which, because of the size of the buffer, there's a problem with the placement of the structure, each one of these ordinances has a variance provision so that it does not have the effect of taking away anybody's use that's authorized by the zoning ordinance. With respect to non-point runoff from construction sites, let's say that Paul was talking about, we have never had a rule that was aimed at addressing that situation. If you go to a typical construction site and you see the barriers, the plastic barriers, those are there as a result of provisions in the building code. So we do this program, the 9-point pollution control program, jointly with DEQ. That's what 6217 and the Coastal Zone Management Act requires, that we do it together with them. And in the couple of years that we've been working on this, the conclusion has been that the smaller construction sites that for years have not been affected by the building code provisions on preventing runoff from the construction site are probably going to have to be addressed, and they're going to be addressed not by regulation but by incentives for landowners. So it's very unlikely that the implementation of 6217 on the coast or elsewhere, to the extent that, well, 6217 only applies on the coast, but other provisions are probably going to apply under the Endangered Species Act or someplace to other parts of the state. It's not likely to be regulatory.
Well, what you just described was regulatory. I don't have a choice about a building site that's going in, and you say put up barricades and barriers or stop this. You're requiring that. I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about. And I'm reading here from some of these grants that you supplied to me, and one of them for $25,000 for the city of Toledo. And in this, it talks about wildlife habitat inventory associated with maps, identifying sensitive populations, protected needs, inventories, maps, habitat. Sounds like overlays coming to me. Geological hazards such as tsunami, floodplains, significant slopes, obtaining data on earthquakes, maps, and these sort of things. Sounds like regulation coming on property to me. Each one of these things, as you read down through here, has that sort of potential within it. So it is a significant impact upon a property owner, because what was described a second ago here was not, you know, like a building site, but in fact with any property. And here's what I'm trying to get a handle on. You folks are doing it. ODF&W is doing it. DEQ is doing it. Department of Ag is doing it. Everyone's doing it. And yet we don't seem to have any clear definition of what is the, how many regulations are going to be applied to this property and what exactly will it look like when the end product is produced. And because when, here's this grant. I'm looking at the grant. It sounds like overlay is being prepared. Help me here. Is that where we're heading?
Senator George, it would be my prediction that at least our part of the Salmon Plan, the principal element of it is working with cities and counties to either adopt riparian ordinances or to improve them. That is a set of regulations, and it works along the lines that I was describing to you. Generally speaking, there is a 20-foot, a 50-foot, or whatever it is, buffer, and it's not a no-build zone. If someone has a buffer across his or her property, and the effect of it is that it would not permit the placement of a structure because the buffer is too wide as applied to that tract of land, there's a variance process. So everybody gets to undertake the use that's allowed in the ordinance. But you're right. I mean, it is a regulation, and it can result in somebody not being able to build a structure where he or she wanted to in the first place. That is clearly a possible and maybe even likely result of that ordinance. Our other part of the salmon plan is this non-point pollution program, and that is not likely. It has not yet, and it is not likely to lead to a set of new regulations. If you look at the salmon plan, and this goes back to when the non-point pollution program began about 6 or 7 years ago, each state was required to analyze each element that the federal government saw that was contributing as non-points was contributing to water quality. They looked at forest practices, agricultural practices, marine practices and marinas, et cetera, and urban runoff. And Oregon's programs passed muster on virtually all of those. The federal government ultimately accepted the Forest Practices Act with some improvements. The Senate Bill 1010, that's the number I was trying to think of for agricultural practices. Eventually, they are going to accept that, I believe. It's the urban runoff one that they have not yet accepted. And the direction to us and DEQ under 6217 has been to improve that program. And we've been working on it, and to date, we do not see new regulations coming through implementation of that program.
Senator Corky, did you have a question or an issue?
Well, Senator George raises an interesting question. He's raised it in other committees, and he's even proposed in other committees that the money from ballot measure 66 be used to repay owners for any takings that might occur on their banks because of the fish plan. And I was just kind of curious who Senator George thinks is the appropriate person to pay for the regulation.
Is this normal to have, it looks like we're developing a little bit of attack here against a fellow member, and I
asking the question.
Senator George, Senator Corcoran, I'll address the issue. I've heard Senator George make the same arguments before many committees, and I think the issue really does find its expression in Measure 66 because we're talking about leaseholds and fee purchases and some of the other things that will provide the ability for the state to actually compensate landowners for changes in management and riparian areas and water rights. So, you know, the issue isn't, in any sense outside the framework of what we put together with Measure 66. And whether you choose to call that a takings, which arguably it is a taking, or just a management change, I think the net effect is the same. We've never had a mechanism to pay landowners
right
for the regulatory changes that we've asked them to do, and I think it's a good mechanism and a good question to ask. So
right, but my question is, who pays? I mean, Senator George, I'm just curious, who pays?
Again, rather than have a colloquy or a dialogue here, I guess the chair would say that at some point in time, if there's a public interest
and a public benefit, there ought to be a public source of financing, and I think voters said so in Measure 66.
Mr. Chairman and Senators, remember that some of the money that the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board passes through to watershed councils or other recipients goes to the cost of riparian restoration. So if, for example, a culvert needs to be replaced or trees are to be planted along a previously destabilized riparian area, the landowner is not paying that cost unless he or she wants to. The grant that goes through GWEB will often pay for that work.
So I guess the issue is, if the broader question is cost share through direct compensation potential, just outright purchase, sometimes these regulations will amount to a taking. And at that point, we've seen some litigation, and I expect there'll be citizen litigation as a result of some of these actions. And I don't know where the takings issue finally will go. We really haven't resolved it anywhere. It's not on the federal level and not on the state level. But at least under the Oregon plan, there's a voluntary mechanism for people to approach that question. Senator Corcoran.
It just creates the conundrum that the same people who attack government all the time because of regulation expect government to then pay for that, and then the question becomes, how do you get the money to pay for it? So I just raise that issue because I just, you know, you hear it over
all we want
three
is
committees over
consistency
6 months.
Here. Yeah. That's the question about local control. You can get the same, you know, the same kind of...
Consistency is the hot stop all
month.
I have to respond to that, and I would be happy at any time to give a clear definition of what my perspective is about government and its responsibilities to its citizens and to the Constitution of the State of Oregon. And I think we're talking about GLTV's budget.
Yeah, that's true. And the other issue is, you know, on the takings questions, I think people are kind of two minds. There are some public interest issues, and it's a matter of degree. We see the elk question. I mean, it's a good illustrator. You've got landowners out there who benefit from having elk on their property because they love wildlife. But talk to the alfalfa rancher who's out there feeding, wintering elk, you know, and not in the few dozens, but sometimes in the hundreds. So that's a real question about a little is a good thing, a lot necessarily isn't such a good thing. There are some benefits. We're trying to deal with that in another arena to try to do something with landowner tags and compensation. We haven't dealt with it yet. But, you know, none of these are going away. And this committee gets a chance to take a whack at it every 2 years. So, Senator Turner.
I think so, Mr. I'm wondering if we wouldn't have enough time to afford it all. She's using that to address maybe some concerns about the overall operation of the coastal zone management program.
I think it's a good suggestion. I guess the other one is, what do we do about the, you know, what is a constructive approach for this committee and this legislature to take facing the federal funding shortfalls? You know, we got federal mandates, federal deadlines, and we didn't get a check to come out of the mail, so I guess, and we do that sometimes to local governments, unintentionally, of course, but let's call up Ethan if Mr. Benner's completed his presentation on the social issues.
Yes,
Mr. Benner, could you make way for Mr. Ethan? Okay. Jeremy and
And don't slide the mic.
No, don't. Oh,
I already did.
It's a really sensitive directional mic.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to make some remarks. Again, for the record, Arno Husing, the director of the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Association. I feel myself in very distinguished company to be joining these two gentlemen here. I just would like to make one point. I served on the DEQ task force on erosion control, and it was very interesting that I'm a real fan of erosion control, and I know there are three communities on the Oregon coast that on their own have said we're going to have erosion control, and it's Astoria, Brookings, and Lincoln City. Interesting, well, the three different parts of the coast, central, south, and north. The experience there is that the contractors actually have embraced it once they understood it. And I guess you can, you know, I'm certified. I have a certificate at home that says Arno Husing has now gone through an erosion control course, and not that I want to do that, but I've attended workshops in Lincoln City, and in the course of an afternoon, the contractors, once they understand how simple it is to do it, and then when they understand it's only like 3 or 4% of the cost of clearing a property and prepping it for development, it's really doable. I think what's going to happen, though, it's probably going to happen under not so much BLCD's jurisdiction, but when communities are asked to work on load allocations under the TMDL process, I predict the first thing they're going to do, they're going to be required to lower the amount of stormwater that goes into their local water bodies. They will be searching for cheap, effective things to do, and I predict we won't even have to regulate it under this program because it's going to happen under the Clean Water Act when the TMDL process kicks in. So as part of the Stormwater Task Force, we had some of the environmentalists saying, God, on a mandate it right now. And I said, well, it's going to happen, you know, my own feeling is going to happen anyway. And I think the irony is that's one of the cheap, easy, real effective things we can do on the stormwater front. But I just want to kind of clear the air with that. And if I go to a coastal community, I'll step right up and talk to the contractors, and I have, and said, this is one I think we can do, especially once they learn how easy it is. As they approach it, they're like, well, what does this all mean? And then once they find out, oh, you mean I just have to lay some fences? I got to do this and do that? I can do that. You know, you don't need an engineer's stamp to do some of this stuff. A lot of it's common sense.
and it's good courtesy you don't have runoff going on the rest. Now, I'll talk about the coastal program in particular. There are times when we've had some disagreements with the Department of Land Conservation Development. I think it's a very tough program that they have to run, though. Land use is a very contentious thing, as Senator George and most of you as elected officials know. A lot of people get very disappointed. They come and they scream and moan. I think what I need to do is probably do a better job of engaging the Department of Land Conservation and Development and the Commission when we have disputes or we have a difference of opinion. Recently we had one, and you invited me to your office, and I think we had a constructive exchange. I pledge to do more of that, and I think, you know, there are frustrations out there, but this program, no matter who administers it, is going to have a certain amount of the frustrations there. So at one point I was saying there's a Senate Bill 489 that would provide a review of the coastal goals. I understand it's difficult to find the money to make that kind of thing happen because Senator Tarno has initiated a larger review of the coastal goals. No matter what happens, whether it's that program or some, I think we can still work hard to try to explain to people why the program works. In fact, tonight I'm going to be in Lincoln City helping to referee what has become a very ugly affair on Goal 17. And a lot of times it's people talking past each other and not really understanding. And it was a case there where some of the people that were a part of the Citizens Advisory Group, I think they went off in an area that they kind of exceeded their authority. Some folks got on there. They're kind of hardcore. They wanted to protect everything. They were not as willing to, work with the kind of variance process. So I hope maybe as of tonight we'll have a better understanding there. I know I've kind of circled around here, and I haven't had a very sharp edge to very many of my comments, but the door swings both ways. If I've got a problem, there have been some issues. The way the AHA situation was handled, I think could have been handled better because it got so ugly down there in terms of the oceanfront issue. And, I think the department should have been down there and Eldon Howe, and maybe Dick, could have walked the site with the people and see the actual circumstances on the ground. I think we've come a long way in places like Florence. The Goal 17 issue, I think some of the people in the community there in Lincoln City had a large hand in kind of going down one end, and we're trying to reel that process in. The Mariner's Village case in Lincoln County, I think there are times, frankly, when the department could do a better job of explicitly saying what the regulation is rather than people have a fair reading of what a regulation is. But I think we can work on those things, and ultimately Mariner's Village, you turned around after the circuit court agreed with Lincoln County, and you rewrote the regulation. A lot of us were hoping that could have happened first. So, I mean, if we're going to do tough things through regulation, we ought to say it explicitly so property owners know what they're in for, so properties don't change hands. And I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chairman. I thank you for the opportunity, but I look forward to working with Director Benner and his staff to make sure we have free and open communications. And I'll work more closely with the LCDC Commission. I think there's some bright, engaging people on there, and if we have some problems, we need to bring it up at that level as well.
I've got a couple of questions for you. One that occurs to me is what does this committee or the legislative members need to do to help break loose some of the federal funding that needs to come to OCZMA and the whole issue of coastal land management, which apparently we're not getting our message across to our congressional delegations. But we get the mandates, but not the money.
Well, we may all, for the last 20 years, there's been talk in the Congress. In fact, when I was a staffer back on Capitol Hill in the early 80s, I worked on this issue of revenue sharing. We were going to take some of the Outer Continental Shelf revenues from oil and gas, the second biggest contributor to the federal treasury, and finally share them with coastal states to help coastal states work on environmental issues that are related to coastal development. That may finally be happening because we finally have a balanced budget and we have the room to maneuver on the Hill, and there's a great number of people, our own congressional delegations, in favor of it. So that might finally happen. That will get us out of the box of finally having sufficient federal dollars. A million or two or three sounds like a lot of money coming from the federal government to go to the LCD, but, by the time you have any kind of adequate staff, that doesn't go very far, and you folks understand budgets probably a lot better than I do. There has been some concern in coastal communities. Only 20% of the funds are passed through, and, of course, we'd like more, but at the same time, I think a lot of us, we don't want to cripple the LCD because The last thing, anyone who gets, who either has a development in front of them, the last thing they don't want is no one at the other end of the phone when it comes to, or their delays in processing time. So, I mean, I think there's an instinct to say, well, let's shrink the agencies, put the money somewhere else. But at the same time, that creates a vacuum at the other end. And we need people, like a DSL, I came to this testimony, gave testimony before, we need people there too. So I'm not certain what the answer is, Mr. Chairman. Of course I'd like more money, not even so much for OCCMA, but to go to some of these local communities. Coos County has got a $20 million budget. They got a $2 million shortfall right now. I mean, that is serious stuff, you know, and there are two Oregon coasts. There's some development pressures on the north end. And I'd love to work with the department more on visual management stuff. I know they're interested in having Columbia Gorge-like features be built into the coastal program to protect some of the scenic viewsheds on the north coast. But I'd also like them to explore, when possible, some regulatory flexibility for stressed communities on the south coast, because it is a tale of two coasts, and one size doesn't fit all. But I think we're basically in a real, it's not a lot of money to spread around. That's part of the problem. With any luck, that box may be broken open, and we have a fair amount of new money coming into the system. I hope, especially if that happens, that a priority is given to pass through more of that money to the local governments. But, you know, right now, I mean, the counties are getting about, what is it, 20 grand, and some of the cities are getting a couple thousand dollars, and, you know, an FTE costs 60, 70, 80, 90 thou, and so it doesn't go a long way, but it's just not a lot of money to begin with, and I think we're all in a box here. There's just not a lot of money to spread around. Mr. Chairman, I'm sure you think I've been very evasive. And
not at all, actually. The other issue, and I think the issue is really at the heart of this question, is what about decentralized or decentralization? I think there's a real clear sentiment that there needs to be somebody at the other end of the telephone, but the other end of the telephone does not necessarily have to end in Salem. So there's a question about having decentralized planning staff from the DLCDC at the coast, where they can do a better job of interface with OCZMA and other local entities.
Well, it was interesting. It wasn't that long ago, Dick, remember how you had the coastal office was literally downstairs from OCZMA, across the street from the post office in Newport, and the two coastal representatives then I think Newport was chosen because of a rather central location that could go north and south. For budget reasons, I think you have to close that office, right? And now Dale Jordan and Dave Perry are having to operate out of Salem and
their cars.
Well, that's 2 hours. They drive 2 hours just to get to the coast before then having to fan out. So I think, you know, yes, there's a presence, but the presence is still having to drive out and from from the valley to come here. Some of us think it's curious that the coastal office is located in Portland. People on the coast wonder about that. Maybe there should be an effort to try to have it somewhere closer to the Oregon coast, or at least in Salem. But again, I think it's a lot of it has to do with resources, and a lot of us, you know, when I think people on the ground have frustrations with DLC, sometimes we bottle it up. They certainly talk to you. You know how it goes. And I think a number of us need to be, you know, I have a lot of confidence. I mean, Dick is a bright guy, and I think he's a pragmatist. I think some of us need to work directly with him on some issues. And
there's no reason to call names.
So, again, I think it's and we've heard it here. It is a resource question. You know, it's very hard to, you know. No doubt about it. I'm not trying to grab a bunch of DLCD money. I want to make that abundantly clear to run our organization. We have wonderful working relationships with, I mean, I run on a third dues, and it's tough in some of these counties, like Coos County right now. Man, what, and Curry County. First thing I learned when I got into my job several years ago, how different county revenue sources are and city revenue. Some of our cities and counties are doing great, and some of them are literally in the poorhouse. So that is a real problem. And but at the same time, trying to tip the balance in the other way, is 20% an adequate amount? I'm not trying to grab money. If anything, I want to make sure as much money as possible does hit the local level. I don't have the answer on what the appropriate breakout is, whether it's 20% or not. But the thing is, if you start dipping too much beyond that, it certainly begins to affect their ability to be on the other end of the phone.
Questions probably from Senator Turner and the rest of the Metro, but we'll go with Senator Turner first.
Question first one, then a comment if I may. Otto, if you were to describe the single most major problem we have on the coast, would you call that 101, Highway 101, as being the biggest problem we have? Well, do you have something else in mind?
Well, from a transportation perspective, certainly the being able to move traffic on 101 and the connector routes to the valley are a big deal, and that's, you know, those are ODOT issues, and, you know, I mean, maybe referring to you have a situation Spencer Creek Bridge where it's about to fall into the ocean, and there's an internal review going on about what to do about that situation. I think we need to accelerate that review, and I know you've written a letter to Grace Krunigan suggesting that one way or another, if tough decisions on riprap have to be made, let's get the public in engaged in the conversation, but we need to have a shorter time frame on when these things get handled.
Chair, I think what I probably should really be kind of looking at all is we see you as a person who helps us get to a middle ground on issues on the coast, because we have a lot of folks there who are concerned one way or the other about losing beach access, losing the ability to get to the beach, and a lot of folks, you mentioned Yahas and Road 804, trying to deal with that dedication, getting rid of that dedicated road or what have you. And I think that the most important thing we have to look at is having somebody in your position help everybody reach that middle ground area so we all can come away feeling a little bit good about what we're doing here.
Well, thank you, Senator Tarn, for your kind remarks tonight. Of course, everyone likes to think they're in the middle, right? That's not unusual for people to. But I think sometimes I get a lot of phone calls like you get. You know, the phone doesn't always get picked up, and unfortunately, when state agencies are doing a good job, they don't call you and they don't call me and say, "God, you know, ODF&W did something really great the other day, and I just want to tell you about it." It's usually
more hard than get you.
It's more of a complaint situation.
I'm back in the hospital now.
And I think, you know, the ball is also in my court. I mean, I think Director Benner and I need to be speaking probably on a more regular basis. If I find out that if I'm getting complaints from coastal communities about the program, I need to go to him and engage him in a dialogue. We had a situation in Lincoln County, and we did have a constructive meeting with the planner and stuff. I think I also need to engage the commission more on if there are issues, so that, and that's really the kind of should be the proper channel of communication. I'm not trying to, you know, I don't want to use this situation or any other situation to kind of parachute in and blindside them with some complaints that we've had, but it's there are tough calls. I mean, it's a tough program, and we need coastal zone management on the Oregon coast. There's no doubt about it. I make that speech to Rotary clubs and real estate folks all the time, and we got to make these riparian buffers work. But a lot of times it's fear. People don't understand that the variance process needs to be in place. And let's face it, there are other organizations on the Oregon coast that deal with environmental issues that I don't think approach some of these debates with the most constructive approach. Unfortunately, things get very polarized very quickly, and once they get there, they're very hard to undo. We've seen that in some of these communities. You know, when Humpty Dumpty's fallen off the wall, it takes quite an effort to put it all back together again. I gave a speech in front of the Newport Chamber of Commerce just a week or two ago talking about the Oregon plan. I said, I think we're this close away to having a major meltdown in all these coastal communities, because when we do Goal 17 stuff, when we do Goal 5 work, I'm on the Lincoln County Planning Commission. I would love for us to do more real, instead of just administering the land use plan day to day, to get out there and do some innovative things on Goal 5 and really get to make sure cities and counties are working better on urban growth boundary expansions, Oregon plan implementation, erosion control. Just, people are scared. The system is complex. They don't understand it. Even their attorneys have to work overtime to understand the system. I think this, in the situation in Lincoln City, is classic. We had a meeting the other day, and we had Don Oswald and some others. We met with a group that was highly polarized. By the time we finally started talking out some of the issues, we said, "Oh, is that what you mean? Oh, you don't mean that. You only mean this? Oh, okay." And so much of the tension just, you know, started deflating out of the room when people, you know, developed communication skills and they stopped chucking spears at each other and actually tried to sit down to a dialogue. But right now, the trust factor is really low. I think there are people in the development community that do that, and there are people in the...
Sure, you give them a minute, and you take an hour.
Senator Tom, I know, and the first rule in testifying in front of a legislative body is keep it short, but these are complicated issues.
So, and actually, he's a less engaging speaker. We've dabbled him down the show.
Everson, Mr. DeGannon, because otherwise what we can do and what I want to do before we end up having to adjourn the meeting at about 5 minutes to 10 for the session is to go ahead and have our legislative fiscal officer walk us through recommendations, and I believe you may have some budget notes that you want to bring for consideration as well. So if you have some questions, so let's do those now, or we can hold those for the walkthrough on this budget text. Okay, so go ahead and have a walkthrough then, Mr. Rockford. Thank you, Mr. Houston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the intention would be to at least go over the LFO recommendations on the budget, and then any areas that the committee wants to look into further, we would have to bring the budget of the department back at a later date, probably early next week, to pass the budget out. I'd provide you with two items, as we've done in the past, a set of spreadsheets on the agency's budget by program, and a memo that is also by program detail. The spreadsheet, the first two pages is the summary of the agency, which includes all of the policy packages and the governor's recommended budget on the first page, and on the second page it summarizes the LFO recommended changes. That first two sheets of summary are then followed by program level detail, the operations program, the grants program, and a new program, landowner notification. On the memo, to begin with, under the operations program, the fiscal office is recommending some general fund base reductions. The total amount is $325,000, roughly $325,018. This includes two types of reduction. One is part of the efficiency reduction directed by the co-chairs, the 4% efficiency reduction, which totals $221,846. There's an additional reduction of $103,172 in the base in order to fund package 101. And on the list there, you see a breakdown of where those reductions are coming from. The $103,000 reduced in the base was then basically added back in package 101, which we're recommending approval. And that package adds four positions for the community solutions team effort. And there's a general fund match requirement for the federal Transportation Efficiency Act funds. And if you look on the spreadsheet, that you can see the total TEA monies are roughly $929,000 that will be transferred from the Department of Transportation to support these packages and these positions. There's also a budget note that the co-chairs have approved. It's on the last page of the memo. And they've suggested including this budget note in each of the agencies that are part of the Community Solutions Team effort. Mr. Chair?
Question.
So, Ms. Caracco, the other funds then that you propose to eliminate in package 102, 104, 107, 302, are they all from the same source, the other funds?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corkin, no, those are separate fund sources in each case. And I'll get to those in 1 second.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Item C in the memo, the LFO recommendation is to eliminate package 102. This package would add two positions for assistance to coastal cities, counties, using GREB grant money. And this is a companion package to 302, which, as we've discussed earlier, would have used money from the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board grant program. And since that agency is going to be succeeded by the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board as part of the funding mechanism for Measure 66 with lottery funds, that those funds would have to be discussed in conjunction with the Measure 66 bill. So we're recommending eliminating that package at this point and then including it with discussions of other priorities in that Measure 66 bill. Item D, the recommendation is to eliminate package 104. This package would add a one staff person to deal with cultural resource protection. In the package, there is no funding source identified, and we're suggesting that if funding can be found, the agency could return to the emergency board and request limitation and position authority from the emergency board. On the second page of the memo, item E, we're recommending approval of package 105, which would add other funds limitations for FEMA funds that are used to provide natural hazard mitigation work. I mean, this is a continuation of an increase in limitation approved by the emergency board in September of 97. We're recommending approval of that package. Item F, we're recommending eliminating package 106, which includes an additional general fund for three positions in the administrative division of the agency. It also, we're recommending the denial of the general fund and the additional positions. It also includes a reclass, however, of the division manager, and we're recommending approval of that. There's no cost for the 99-01 biennium, and basically the reason for that is to bring that particular position in line with the other program managers of the departments. In item G, we're recommending eliminating package 107. This package would add other funds limitations to our soils analysis efforts through professional services. We're recommending that the package just be eliminated and tied to the bill, Senate Bill 333. If that bill moves in the legislature, we could add appropriate expenditure limitations to that bill. However, I don't think that bill has received a hearing, and it looks like it's dead. So we're recommending eliminating those other funds resources from this budget. And item H, we're recommending eliminating package 108. This is a difficult package for the department. This would be the addition of about $175,000 general fund for legal costs. And as Mr. Benner described earlier today, the last legislature basically reduced the amount of legal services support to the agency and appropriated it to the emergency board. Eventually, the agency got nearly all of the money restored through the emergency board process. However, it was not included in the base budget because the cutoff date for base budget inclusion was passed by the time the emergency board made the final action. At this point, there is no additional general fund available in the legislative budget plan, so we're recommending denial of this package and suggesting to the agency that if they're unable to maintain their legal activities within the base budget expenditures that they have authority for, that they could approach the emergency board at a later date and try to get additional legal support.
Okay. Question?
Just to talk so I understand correctly then. So basically, in terms of the legal fees, we're reducing the available funds based on last year's expenditures by about 60%, about 40%. Is that about right? I mean, because before there was money allocated to the emergency corps. Now there's no money allocated with the setting.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I'm not sure of the exact percent that what you're saying is.
Well, it's 324 that was actually spent, in the current biennium. And that includes the base budget plus the money that was appropriated then after request for to the emergency board. And so this 174 that we're eliminating, we're not making any allocations to the e-board. So basically it would be that if they need some money, then they go and hope that it's somehow pulled out of a hat somewhere if there's money needed.
That's correct.
Question.
So, Mr. Benner, in practical terms on the ground, if you're only given a budget of half the amount of hours that you project that you're going to need, how do you, since Mr. Husing called you a pragmatist, how do you spend that money down? Do you spend it down in sort of normal behavior until the clock is beat, or do you try to use it over the biennium and does that slow down appeals and so forth? Kind of curious about how you, as a manager, look at that.
Senator, this would be a different situation for us from last biennium. Last biennium, we knew that there was $150,000 at the emergency board, and what the subcommittee told us was that when we needed it, we could come to the emergency board and demonstrate that we needed it, and it would be there. This time it will not be there. Consequently, I will have to reduce our program to be consistent with the approximately 2,000 hours of service that will be available to us with $195,000. Exactly how I'm going to do that, I don't know, but I think I've mentioned to you that we spend in about 8 different categories, ranging from the appeals that we take to the Land Use Board of Appeals, to rulemaking, to advice to the commission. And as a result of the cut that we experienced this biennium, we've pretty much told the attorney not to come to our commission meetings anymore. And I guess he would simply tell the Attorney General's office not to come, and we'll muddle through. He would probably cut down significantly on enforcement. He would file no or very few appeals. I presume we would also have to look at the rulemaking that you asked us to do, figure out what we could afford to pay for, and not do the rest, or come to you in an emergency board fashion and ask for money to do that rulemaking. So I would say probably the principal casualty would be the quality of advice to the commission and the department from the Attorney General's office. We would simply not be able to go to them, and we would not be able to enforce it, or very little of it.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Question.
And so give me a flavor of the enforcement that you don't think you'd be able to do. Give me an example.
There are two types of enforcement that the department does. For example, in a plan amendment, let's say Cottage Grove does a plan amendment. Under the law, they notify us that they are about to do a plan amendment. Let's say it's an urban growth boundary expansion. Somebody from the department will review the proposed urban growth boundary expansion. The great majority of them are fine, and that's the end of it. Some of them we think, let's say this one, we believe does not comply with Goal 14. Maybe it's too much land, maybe it's in the wrong place as we see the goal. If we are not able to persuade the City of Cottage Grove to do it in a different way, then we would file an appeal with the Land Use Board of Appeals, asking the Land Use Board of Appeals to apply the goal to the situation and try to get the decision changed. If we do not have money to file the appeal, we will not file the appeal. And the result will probably be a violation of the goal. That's a fairly typical situation. The other kind of enforcement that we do under the statute is called an enforcement order. And we've done this about 25 times in the 25-year history of the program. It's when a local government engages in a pattern of decision-making. The most recent one was Washington County approving dwellings in its farm zone, about 62, which we felt violated the goals. A petition is filed with the commission, and the commission can order Washington County to stop making approvals of those farm dwellings, of those dwellings.
until there is an opportunity to determine why that is happening and for the county to make corrective measures. Each one of those costs us about $15,000 to $30,000. Although the statute says that we must do that, if the commission finds that there is a pattern of decision-making that violates the goals, we would not have the resources to do it. I think what would happen in that instance is we would come to the next available emergency board to seek the money to do it. In the meantime, the violations would continue. So that, in my estimation, would be a bad state of affairs. But that's where we would be. Thank you.
I'll put your question, Senator Corcoran. I think the base budget has $195,000 for litigation.
Okay, that's not for litigation, Senator. That's for all the services. Rulemaking, advice to the commission. One other thing I want to make sure that you understand, when the commission enters an order, for example, in a periodic review, Brookings came to us in periodic review for an urban growth boundary expansion. My commission approved it, and we were immediately sued by the opponents of the expansion. We had to defend that decision, and it's been going on for some time. It was very expensive, but we have to defend commission orders as well. That's one of the categories.
Okay. And let me see if I get – let me recast the issue that I want the community to understand. There's $195,000 in the base for all legal services from the AG's office. Part of that undoubtedly will be litigation. There is a new emphasis on the community solutions approach to solving and resolving issues with some more emphasis. Possibly some of the disputes don't turn into litigation. There still may be additional need for legal services. And then there is a base position funded for dispute resolution. And even though we've recommended against the $12,000 option package in this LFO recommendation, there is the Dispute Resolution Commission that we are, in another area in general government, increasing the support. So there's some other mechanisms that ought to lower the threshold of pain, provide dispute resolution mechanisms, emphasize community solutions. And with $195,000 in the base, there really is no difference in what we've done in terms of the mechanism. If you have a clear indication that you're going to have a litigation budget that exceeds the services budget that we've approved for all legal services from the AG's office, you will go to the legislative e-board. And even though we haven't reserved dollars in there, that you basically can draw on any dollars that have been allocated to the e-board for use by state agencies. And I can't imagine that they would turn away a legitimate request for legal funds if that's necessary. The difference is that we won't have earmarked dollars and actually allocated those dollars, which are a charge against the agency's budget. Question?
Mr. Chair, that is exactly my concern. The situation is different this time in that there is no earmarked money. So then I ask the question, how do you respond to that as an agency manager? The response is, we won't do enforcement. You take the Cottage Grove example on the UGB. I have a group called Grandmothers from Hell. They're going to go in and say that they're not complying with the statutory requirements.
Senator, do you really have a group called Grandmothers?
Yes, but they actually deal with child custody stuff, and that's my name for them. But anyway, I won't name the group that would go after these guys. You know, they're the, save the spawning trees or something. But anyway, what they would do is they would go after Mr. Benner and say, you're not upholding statutory requirements, and we'd be in court. So the few dollars we'd save, you know, and we would have all these outraged people saying, you know, every dispute ends up being in court, and the LCDC would be sued, the city would be sued. So I'm not convinced, and this is peanuts compared to the rest of these budget concerns that we have. I mean, we just put $13 million additional money into higher education for agricultural stuff. So, you know, I just, it worries me from a public policy standpoint that we nickel and dime some of this stuff, and it ends up biting us in a place on our anatomy that we don't enjoy being fit.
I do appreciate that. I guess the budget notes that I'm also looking at are the idea that this additional $130,000 would have been included in the base budget. The legal fees, et cetera, had they made the cutoff date for inclusion in the base budget, it didn't happen. I have no reason to doubt in the world, and I don't really think Mr. Garner does it either, that
that the average litigation cost for the agency will be close to what it was in the last biennium.
It was $130,000, $140,000, or up to $174,000 that we looked at as an option package. And I guess I expect that that will come from an allocation from the e-book. And I don't expect there not to be enforcement actions taken or not to be legal services required from the state attorney general. I don't see the difference in the mechanism other than we're not allocating an e-board reservation this time. But that doesn't mean that the agency isn't going to ask for the money from the e-board. Your objections are noted.
Just a concern, not really an objection. I don't know if I'm going to vote against the budget or not, but it's just...
we got such good momentum here, and we're on... a couple of minutes before the session, we're on I.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Item I is we're recommending approving the package with some adjustments. This is the management restructure package. It's proposed to move four natural resource specialist four positions to a principal executive management D class, which is a managerial class. We're recommending approving the reclass, but moving those to an NRS-5 classification rather than a management D class. And it also includes three other reclasses that we're recommending approval for. If you note on the box on the far right, there's numbers there. Those should not be there because we're recommending funding of the package. You can cross those out. Item J, we're recommending eliminating package 110. This would provide general fund to supplement the dispute resolution position that Mr. Benner talked about. And we're proposing to add a budget note there that would direct the agency, LFO, and BAN budget management to work on some details on how to fund this package or fund the position fully from dispute resolution commission resources as it had originally been intended to do. So there's proposed budget note language there. Item K.
Question?
Before we go to item 10, sorry, Mr. Rocco. Again, I'd like to know sort of on the ground what the impact, if there is no capability of the agency to work with LFO and budget management of DAS to adequately fund the delivery of the service, what happens?
Senator, we eat it. That means we have to find the money someplace else, and we don't really have much money anyplace else. So we end up reducing service in some other place to make up the $12,000. I'm not going to reduce the person's salary, so I will cut someplace else.
The intention there, and I think the budget note explains that there was an intention that the Dispute Resolution Commission didn't make grants to these programs, and that's where we think this $12,000 comes from. That's the plan anyway. We'll see what happens. Mr. Rock, would you continue?
Mr. Chair, item K is simply a budget note that we're suggesting to, as we discussed yesterday, to give the agency the ability to go to the emergency board to deal with rulemaking costs that may result from various pieces of legislation that passed from the body this time and are signed into law. At this point, we don't know the full effect of those costs, and there may be additional costs beyond what the agency is able to absorb within their base budget.
Colleagues, I'm going to reluctantly leave the presentation of the rest of these budget items to a future date subject to posting, and I guess that I'll just continue this work session and public hearing until tomorrow. So that we can continue consideration of these grants issues and the rest of LFO recommendations. I appreciate your indulgence and apologize to the committee for making you look for your session before.